You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 26th of October, 2022. Many of you already know this, but I'm going to repeat again that a very important book of mine has finally been finished. Really just because I didn't want to deal with it anymore. You know, I'm never going to be satisfied with it. I'm never going to be satisfied with anything I put out. But it's a very important book to summarize. Connection between metaphysics and the Church Fathers, who were of immense importance in the rest of Western civilization, mostly Greek speakers. And the political payoff, of course, is what nominalism means, an idea with the history of science, political philosophy, and everything else. It's not just ethereal metaphysics. Published on Gromata Press, or Gromata Books, actually. And there's a Kindle version as well as a softcover version on Amazon. I appreciate the support of my friends, you guys listening. You've made it possible for me to do these kinds of projects because you support me financially when there's no one else who will. There's no government, there's no church, there's no corporation, there's no non-profit, nothing like this. You guys have, through fairly small donations over time and buying my books and everything, have made it possible for me to live a life of reflection, academic contemplation, to use the ancient term, without being tethered to an institution. I am completely independent in an enviable way, and it's because of you. Buying books and donating, especially direct donations, signing up for my Patreon, all this brings me to this level of independence. And I can't thank you enough for that. It's something I never expected to happen. And it is just almost unprecedented. For those who've known me for even a short time, I am a monarchist. And so much of my academic work since grad school has been in the juxtaposition of ethno and religious nationalism on the one hand and the institution of the monarchy on the other. And since the monarch is a paterfamilias, it harkens back to a true sense of family, not literally biological, only indirectly biological, which is what ethnicity is. It's much larger than a family. But it's meant to function in roughly the same way, the family being a mini version of society. We're talking about symbol. Concept of the royal court, the crown, manifests this hierarchy of the cosmos, hierarchy of nature, from the most specific and material to the most general and spiritual. That doesn't mean abstract. It may sound abstract, but it has just as much of a concrete foundation as the material world does. And this is the central concept of nominalism versus realism. It's extremely important. Now, this manifestation and personalization of the cosmic hierarchy, especially as it concerns justice, is done through symbols. Remember, a symbol is not the opposite of substance. A symbol is a gateway. It's the beginning point to getting deeper and deeper into the inner workings of reality, reaching the form of whatever it is, form of the good, the form of strategy, the form of virtue, whatever. Now, when you live in a nominalist society, and you have a society that takes nominalism for granted, That's where you get symbolism as the opposite of substance, because a symbol can't be a gateway to anything, since really all reality is just a set of symbols or labels that humanity gives to certain things that we group together, whether it be a species or goodness or love or anything like that. There's nothing for it to introduce you to. What that means, with the payoff there, is Machiavelli. This is why Leo Strauss has him as the founder of modernity, because of what symbols ended up becoming. If symbols are not a way to manifest the hierarchy of the cosmos, the spiritual hierarchy of values based on concrete universality, then the only possible function that they could have, other than decorative, is to manipulate others. Now, they can be both true. You do want in the Byzantine court, which is what we're going to talk about today. The Byzantine court was meant not merely to manifest and personalize the natural hierarchy, the cosmic hierarchy, but also to give, to show how powerful it is, to show how supreme it is to all other civilizations. Like everything else, civilizations were manifest in a hierarchy. The Byzantine, Romans, were the top tier. Rome is not a place, it's an idea. It can be manifest, instantiated in a place, but it isn't reducible to a place. There's nothing special about, you know, the topography of Constantinople for it to be, you know, this is predestined to be the home of Rome for a while. That's not the issue. But Rome is this very idea of a spiritual hierarchy, as the concept has been refined over time. The concept here is the personalization of this very hierarchy, the personalization of the form of justice and good, form in the sense of archetype. This is a natural human proclivity. The entire pre-Christian pantheon of these heroes and images is meant to personalize specific aspects of the natural or social world. That's what they're there for. It's a way to humanize the world around us by attaching a personality to it. The modern world, only in human beings is there any such thing as a personality or a personal will. All scientific concepts, as dead and as empty as they can be, don't have a will of their own. And even in a limited sense, they're simple abstract objects. Yet human nature is to personalize, to project humanity onto what we know and understand. And that goes for universal concepts like justice, as well as any natural force. Legitimate science does have a place, but that's not the issue here. But in the hierarchy of values, it's fairly low. It's what science bases itself on, the foundations of the scientific method. That's a different story. That's much higher. In fact, this is the personalization of justice and the cosmic order is what the symbolism and the regalia of monarchy is, and especially as it's manifest in the royal court. You could learn a tremendous amount about medieval, even ancient political theory by analyzing the symbols found within the royal court, the palace. No different than a church. Church, there isn't a square inch of an Orthodox or, say, a Gregorian Roman church that isn't saturated with symbolism. This introduction of the common people to the order of the form, to logos. It's very common for modern writers to look down on medievals as illiterate. But you take one of these same people and bring them to a medieval church, they won't know a single symbol that they see, even though they're drowning them. So the medieval can very easily say to the modern, "You're illiterate." Symbols are far more powerful than mere words. there was a hierarchy of civilization. This Byzantium, Rome on top, about set. In second place, I'm not going to list everyone, I'm going to list the big three here. Second place was given to the Eastern powers, the Persians, the Sassanids, the various Islamic caliphates. They didn't claim to be Roman. They didn't claim pure universality, although Islam actually does. So much of their civilization came from the ancient Greeks, especially Aristotle, anyway. And they could be bitter enemies. They still ranked second. I'm pretty sure ancient medieval China would also be on that second tier. The great civilizations that are not Roman. Significantly, the lowest tier hierarchy of civilization is made up of the Western petty kings, especially these petty kings who claim the mantle of Rome. There is very little that will irritate a Byzantine emperor more than a fairly primitive, powerless war band claiming to manifest the truth of Rome. Now, as many of you know, I don't take such a harsh view of the Western Middle Ages. I've been a defender of the Western Middle Ages as almost a dominant preoccupation since college. And I distinctly remember moderns, of course, in order to justify their own society, have to claim that the Middle Ages were barbarous. And of course, the exact opposite was true. However, there was no comparison between the cities of the West and Constantinople. So it's not merely in universality and metaphysics that Byzantium was at the heart, but also in simple practical terms. The Byzantine court, and this was the case in many, within Christendom anyway, the court itself was meant to be a reflection of cosmic order, this very same hierarchy of values. And it didn't take long for the symbolism, even the location of the Byzantine court itself, as a venerable ancient institution that recapitulates the metaphysical order of the world. It began with the Emperor Diocletian and continued to deepen and reached another level with St. Constantine. And it continued to develop and get more complicated because, of course, society is complicated. Justice is a complex idea, and these offices were all meant to represent a piece of it. There were 82 offices in the 11th century in the Byzantine court. That is to say, there were 82 main titles, with the emperor obviously being first, the Caesar. Underneath that was the local Caesar. Western petty kings wouldn't be in that category. The Caesar is a local national entity, like Bulgaria or Russia, that's within the Byzantine orbit. Literally or simply symbolically, it doesn't matter. The Patriarch, of course, is also on this same level. Underneath that, the royal family. Especially members of the royal family who are not in the line of succession, certain brothers, whatever. Then the admiral of, or the sorry, the head of the fleet and the head of the infantry, high military ranks. And then, of course, the blues and the greens, or the circus faction. This is a lot more than mere sport, I think, as some of you know. And then the heads of civil departments. So it's not merely the state that, I mean, there's many more, this is the most important ones. It's not just the state that's being represented here. It's all social reality. Society is natural to human beings. This is what anomalies can never reach. Human nature reaches its, from a secular point of view, its full manifestation within society. I didn't say state. That's a different story. The state is also extremely important, but a bit lower in the hierarchy of values. It's a more practical matter rather than a metaphysical. It's simply it's a necessity. But the concept of the state, this era, and where we live today, of course, have nothing in common. And this was the hierarchy as manifest in the offices of the court. And all of these, whether major or minor, that's not really important, all of them had both duties and benefits. And to some extent, it's also used to grant favors as a way to... It was an arena, so to speak, for noble factions to either exist in conflict or cooperation. It's to give not only does, of course, manifest reality, but also provide, in practical terms, a way to bring the nobles to a position of some prominence, but not excessive, because the nobility is beneath the emperor in terms of metaphysical dignity. And the emperor, Byzantine state, brought ambassadors to Constantinople. This is something that the Byzantines have really pioneered. The superiority, this very hierarchy, the cosmos, is meant to be shown. Of course, it's meant to impress. It's not just a claim that Byzantium is the highest in the rank of the metaphysical empire, from a metaphysical point of view, I should say. But we're showing it. As always, personalization and symbolization, this is simply a part of human nature. This is what we're driven to do. We project our own selfhood onto the world around us and provide it with a will, provide it with a personality. It's a sense not only of superiority of Byzantium and Rome, to really say, but also the insignificance of the individuals who represented the other civilizations. The Ceremonious is a work by Constantine Porphyrogenitus VII, and it laid out, to some extent, the symbolism of the court, but also how, obviously the word ceremony comes from this title, how the Eastern dignitaries were to be treated. So high civilization underneath Rome. Remember, part of this is that Islam, other civilizations, don't have a full understanding of logos. To fully express logos, most of human beings can. That's in the realm of Rome, and that's what puts it, among many other things, puts it at the top of the hierarchy. And Constantine talks about the court, especially when you're bringing non-Orthodox other ambassadors from Islam, whatever, caliphates, to see the emperor, which, as we'll see, is a big deal. And he says that it isn't just a matter of power. It's power as authority. That is to say, it has to be congruent to the hierarchy of values that exists in the cosmos. In fact, that is the cosmos. It's a natural order that comes from God, and it is manifested at the highest level by the Byzantine state. The foreigners also had to understand this, not just in an intellectual way, but also in a personal way. Like everything, it has to be personal. And for an embassy, a delegation coming from the East, and this is just for the East, by the way, preparing to receive a delegation often took months. Everything had to be perfect because it's representing something that is ethereal and extraordinary in material terms, which is not an easy thing to do. Let me give you an example. This is in terms of superiority. In the Byzantine dealings with Baghdad, before period we're dealing with, the ambassadors from Constantinople laid out and copied in their books the floor plan of the court at Baghdad. The ambassadors, that wasn't their purpose, but something that they did, went back to Byzantium, and what the emperor did was build a vacation home on a coast somewhere with that very same floor plan. In other words, what you think is high culture, I respect, but I'm only going to make a vacation home out of it. It's almost like the deliberate breaking of very expensive objects in the palace as a way to show that this doesn't, but we have so much of it that it doesn't mean, but it also doesn't mean anything. This isn't about wealth, but a certain level of wealth is necessary to do all of this. And when you consider the massive inequality amongst the world cities compared to Constantinople, it was meant to, for lack of a better term, shock and awe. But these are the symbolic ways in which the emperor would show his superiority. This has nothing to do with him as a person. That's, in many ways, irrelevant. It has to do with his position as manifesting and personalizing natural law. The city itself, of course, was meant to impress. The city itself was so large and wealthy and populated that it doesn't matter where you're coming from, you couldn't help but be impressed. The triple walls that surrounded the city were at the time an architectural marvel. When ambassadors are being brought into the city, they're passing these very busy, these wealthy courts. High dignitaries and ships, and once they see wealth and power, it's a very, very choreographed, or I should say ritualized is a better word. The Easterners are eventually brought into the Golden Audience Hall, which was the creation, among other people, of Justin II and Basil I, or at least they were able to refurbish it. And the palace itself, the centerpiece, is a gold dome representing the heavens, upheld by 8 great arches. We've dealt with the symbolism of not only arches, but the number 8. I've done this many times before in my book on medieval political thought as well. The throne is made of gold. Gold mostly, because it's rare, but because of its symbolism. It's more connected with the god Apollo. Masculinity and rationality. And that throne is set behind brass rails. It is lit by the sun. These things were done during the day, and you had 18 windows, and 16 windows, and lit by the sun. The St. Theodore Oratory is the room just off of this that held the imperial crown and the rod of Moses. Those were the two great relics of the empire. It's also a noble room. And to the south of that, the silver doors, notice they're not gold in this case, refers to the private quarters of the empire. Now, why is it silver? Because the individuality of the emperor is much less significant than the emperor part of the equation. He has to both be a man and an emperor. Silver, of course, is secondary. It's the moon. It's changing. It's not as strong. And to a great extent, many of the dignitaries from the high civilization, east and south, will be aware of the symbolism. The great, rather extraordinary mosaic designs were to be found on all over the walls, the ceilings, and the floors. Stepping on things didn't necessarily mean a matter of disrespect. And some of these still survive, not just in the palace, but all over, especially the Roman nobility. Noble estates, depending on how high they were, the hierarchy, always tried to imitate the pageantry of the royal palace. In the throne of the emperor, I think some of you probably think of the south, above the throne, I should say, is the icon, circular icon of Christ, Pentacrit, or the all-powerful creator, creation out of nothing, not architecture. And it's in a circle for that very reason. There is no beginning and there is no end. The Mother of God, very close by, representing the human side of the equation, and the Mother of God is always the patroness of the city. The city was consecrated to Mary. It's significant to note that fresh flowers were to be found everywhere. Maybe this is Greece, or what today is extreme northern Turkey. That even nature itself blooms within the palace. Flowers, too, are a part of this natural world, and have a specific role, both biologically and symbolically, within the hierarchy. A lot of this is meant to make the visitor seem insignificant, because as an individual, of course they were, and they pale in significance, even as a civilization, to the Roman, which is the highest manifestation of justice. Ideally speaking, of course, this has nothing to do with the phenomenal realm. This has to do with the noumenal realm. Phenomenal realm, there are all kinds of problems and errors and corruption. That's not relevant. We maintain the apostolic standard no matter how far we might be from. Every day the emperor would leave the throne room and make his daily march to Hagia Sophia, or the Cathedral of Divine Wisdom. This was a way to ritualize the city. This procession throughout the city was meant to consecrate it, showing that it is a recapitulation of what a city is supposed to be in the ideal sense. But concerning the throne, ambassadors come to the throne room. It is flanked by often large groups of men holding scepters, different types of crowns, and relics of every kind imagined, military and otherwise. And then that's also, that very room is where state banquets were held. And this was the apogee. This was the highest point, the zenith of any ambassador's visit with their delegation to Constantinople. These symbols that you found everywhere were meant to be the personification of imperial functions, including these offices. But that's also a reflection of human nature. This is from the Abbasid delegation of Islam, specifically. And on their way in, they had to walk past all of these officers, military and otherwise. Now, they are taken into the banquet room through, sometimes even come through the hippodrome. They come through these mazes of corridors, and they come to the west hall of Justinian. And in fact, in order to be presented to the emperor, you had to wear special clothing. These were vestments in a kind of semi-liturgical function. Within the golden throne room is where the banquet tables were and couches. And plates, golden of course, were lowered from the ceiling, as if to give the impression that this is a spiritual realm, not connected with simple cause and effect. And then behind the couches for everyone, you have even more officers lined up. You have acrobats, you have dance, gold scepters, relics. Most of the utensils are of gold. Then the ambassadors were absolutely lavished with gifts, and even their courtiers were given thousands of silver coins. It was meant to be an incredible display of wealth and authority. Power, maybe, but power based on authority. Authority is the connection between the state and logos. Only then would negotiations ever begin. So, after the banquet was almost a liturgical function in and of itself. Now, what about the Western Petty King? This does vary slightly in time and place. Now, I'm taking this from Upra, who at the time was visiting the palace as an agent of Otto II. And the fact that at this point in the Middle Ages, this German Empire was calling itself Roman meant that Utopriant and many others are not going to be treated very well. So this is going to be the opposite of what happened to the Eastern dignitary. And in fact, he was there at this point to discuss a marriage alliance to connect East and West. Now, Otto, Germany, this period of time, these are a special case because soldiers of the empire had been removed from parts of Italy by the Germans. And this was, they were actively at war, at least in certain parts of Italy. So that means that when Otto sends him to negotiate this alliance, Otto's under the impression that he is working from a position of strength. But that's not how Byzantine political thought operates. Great emperor, like Nicephorus II, saw them almost as children. Barbarians who don't understand their place in the world. Now, what was their reception like? Upriand and his delegation had to wait outside the walls in the rain for hours and hours and hours. Only then, when the official came out, sort of like the Emerald City, the Wizard of Oz, an official comes out and says that they could enter. However, they have to leave their horses. They can only go on foot in the mud, of course. They were then taken to their lodgings, which was very cold and very stripped down. It would be unfurnished. It would be cold in every sense of the term. There would be a guard to watch them. Again, this is all very humiliating. A guard to watch them, and he would respond to nothing. Asking for something, he was instructed not to reply. Then a warden, a different office, ultimately was there to extort them, offering favors for whatever they had brought. When they brought quite, these are large delegations that brought quite a number of resources with them. This isn't just a visit of one or two people. The wine that they were given was undrinkable. That plaster and it pitch rosin, and as if that's not bad enough, they had to sleep on the floor. To get to the palace, they had to walk through the entire city. No protection, no directions. Here they are, filthy by now, freezing, not fed well, drinking garbage, and walking through the city trying to find the palace. Of course, when they get to the palace, the emperor isn't there. He's never there. And there's a whole bunch of excuses as to why he's not. All kinds of delaying tactics. If you've ever been on the phone with an insurance company, it's something like this. No real answer to their questions you've ever given. They even considered leaving, which, by the way, is a whole separate ordeal. Yet again, they were standing outside the palace for hours. Finally, the summons shows up. They're able to enter. This is why Supriand wrote his scathing treatment of the Byzantine court. That's why it really should be discounted, because he was very angry. Legitimately or not, he was very angry. So his first-hand account of Byzantium is often used as a primary source. Of course, it is a primary source, but needs to be used and cited with caution. And he called the emperor a dwarf, he had beady eyes, he's fat, you know, just whatever you could think of, these personal attacks. Given you know how he was treated, and it shouldn't shock anyone that the negotiations didn't go well. There was going to be no alliance. Now, of course, Byzantine princesses were married off to Western kings all the time, but remember, there's a war in Italy, and it's important to note Of course, as I've said before, that Otto and the German Empire was claiming itself as a Holy Roman Empire. And not only that, the Germans tried to take the imperial title in South Italy, which was a shocking, a daring thing for them to do. That's why they were treated this way. This was, in their opinion, an ongoing military campaign, but a military campaign designed to usurp Rome and bring it to Germany, capturing Rome itself precisely for this very reason. And only for this very reason. And to add even more injury to the insult, they would make demands that would be, diplomatically speaking, outrageous. For example, that he had to pull out of Italy entirely, which is a slap in the face. You have no right to be there. You're even lower than a Caesar. Now, if they had a full diplomatic relationship, they were part of the Byzantine Commonwealth, that would be a second tier. But because of their claim to supremacy, this psychological treatment, it wasn't just him, any number of these delegations, and making these wild demands for me they can never get. Yes, you create this marriage alliance, but just get out of Italy, like that would ever happen. Finally, exhausted, the delegation asked to return home. Please let us leave. And the emperor said no. He was then confined with his retinue to the very sparse cold quarter. And he had to go through this every day. He had to do the same thing every day with the same treatment. He was denied for weeks and months. In fact, it was a total of 120 days. Which certainly is an important number. And after this period of time, they were finally allowed to leave. So as he's at the border, that very day, he's accosted and said that there's a new law that the emperor has just promulgated, just today, and that is that all silk had to be declared at the border. So the gifts that were meant for Otto from the emperor, so many of them were silk or clothed in silk, had to be given back. And all kinds of, the law would change, different, whatever it might be. Gold couldn't leave the empire, stuff like that. Whatever it took to even take back the gifts that they had given, knowing full well that this is going to anger Otto. And this is where so many of the anti-Byzantine polemics come from. That they are simply, Byzantines are, you know, this labyrinth that you have to go through is symbolic for the emperor, and we use the word Byzantine as an epithet, a negative one, which is stupid. It just means complex, but complex almost with a purpose. And the palace itself, I go through this to show the difference between civilizations. Ideally, now there are many times where the West wasn't treated this way, it depends on circumstances, but these are pure forms, these are ideal types of how the civilizations were to be treated. And Germany had a particularly bad reputation because of the war in Italy and the claim of the Roman title. The caliphates and caliphates in Syria and Egypt were not making these claims. Even if they were at war, they were not making claims to universality. This is a central philosophical point, an ideological point in making sense out of the mind of the empire. The palace itself is in the eastern part of the city, which shouldn't be a huge shock. The altar is in the eastern part of the church. And you did have classical monuments all over the place. They're connecting themselves with not just Orthodox Greece, but ancient Greek civilization, which has now been raised even higher to that of the Roman. And again, churches, reception halls, all tremendous wealth to bring awe to visitor. You know, the court itself is a fixed point of the empire. It is a sacred space that requires vestment and ritual, no different than any church. Again, it's not the emperor as a man. It's what the emperor is, what he is ontologically, that matter. I mentioned the Golden Hall before. That was created by Justinian II. The throne itself is elevated. And I didn't mention this before, but it's flanked by two golden lions that roared. So you had a tremendous technological development, where lions that actually made noise, despite them being, of course, mechanical and golden, but this technology didn't exist elsewhere. They had golden birds that sang. All of this, as the ambassadors coming into the, and this goes for Western, it doesn't anybody who comes into the sight of the emperor. You see ivory tables. They use onyx quite a bit. Gold ornaments everywhere. And as the visitor actually gets to the throne room itself, the throne then is elevated into the air. So you enter into the room, you see the emperor on a golden throne for the first time. It now, it's like a riser that then goes up into the air, stressing the spiritual side of things. It's rising above the physical. And as that's going on, the lions and the birds are making their natural noise. As I mentioned before, golden plates are brought down from the ceiling. In other words, this shows a tremendous knowledge of physics, a command of the natural order. Of course, there was no concept of replacement, but there is a deep and detailed knowledge of the natural order. But I should note, with all of these offices, this huge hierarchy, they were open to everyone. I mean, you had to speak Greek, of course. But if a commoner showed talent, he really didn't have orders of nobility like you had elsewhere. These were practical manifestations of justice. Talent mattered. If you could serve the empire, you had a literal God-given gift. And this is part of this idea of the court and the throne, specifically the regalia, as a integration, a symbolic integration of all aspects, not just of government, but of society and the economy. And all of this connected to Logos, in the sense we've been saved by it. This connection creates this ontological distinction. Educated men, this is a highly literate empire, educated men usually went, that weren't churchmen, went to the civil service. There was always a demand for lawyers, always a demand for scribes. You had eunuchs, and you had bishops, and you had senators, and you had military factions. All of them manifest those aspects of society within the throne room itself. I mean, but these things were open to everybody. There's nothing intrinsic about a family that deserves to have exposition in society. That's a superstition. There's a certain Gnostic element to that was rejected. I mean, even the wife, if an emperor, or even before he becomes emperor, when he comes time to be married, the empress, the mother, would organize these bridal shows. And you didn't have to be from a powerful family. You're a beautiful woman. This was your chance. Get to the capital, get involved in this show, and you may be chosen as the wife. The Russians did the exact same thing in the Tsarist era. The court was open to all stations. This is an extremely important point. Metaphysically, ontologically, spiritually, it is fixed because the hierarchy of creation is fixed. That doesn't change. The other side of that, of course, are the individuals. That's a different story. That's lesser than the office. But the individual, of course, matters. This is a personification of something. Some aspect of justice or goodness manifests in one of these offices. And there's This is part of what Dionysius mentioned. I have a whole section on Dionysius in my book. You know, why the angels are ordered in hierarchical ninefold order, and how that is manifest in the church in the physical sense. And of course, angels are physical. Anyway, the individuality was a simple matter of practical talent and ability. Now, of course, we know that Greek princesses, as I said, were married to German kings. I'm sorry, I should say Western kings. The emperors of John II and Isaac II, for example, had Hungarian wives. But that was a matter of practicality. Of course, the family is at the root here. It's not merely an individual. We talk about the individual will. Even that was secondary to the family system that created it. And these gifts, there are a few academic pieces on this. The gifts are manifestations of the relationship. And it also reflects your position in the hierarchy. For the sin of usurpation, the sin of Lucifer, which is what they accused the Germans of doing and claiming to be a Roman state, those gifts were taken back at the border. It's meant to symbolize the reprobate relative to grace. Islam, the Slavs, enemies, friends, gifts, mutual gifts, each having a very specific function. And it's meant to give a very specific message. They cemented, they manifest these relationships. This the gift economy is almost the very opposite of a market economy. Your position in the hierarchy, not mere demand, it's a quantitative very matters. In the court itself, this is where you found the 53-volume encyclopedia. There are many who will tell you that the encyclopedia was created, well, by the group of Frenchmen called encyclopedias, as something connected to the Enlightenment. The encyclopedia, the word encyclical is in it. This is the summation and summary, the summation of all knowledge. And there are volumes on diplomacy, history, marriage, military strategy. And this mentality, the knowledge of not just the empire, but its historical development, is found in the palace too. Because this knowledge is extremely important. And it existed straight up until 1453. Now I'm going to do this separately, but I have a lecture prepared also on the Greek fire. I've been asked about that since I started this. Not necessarily its symbolic, but it also obviously can be. We first hear about this, and again, this is we talked about the control, the knowledge of physics and mechanics. When you see this, you can imagine someone from backwater coming and seeing this solid gold throne lifted high in the air with smoke and roaring golden lions. They're not actually, they're statues. Their mouth moves, they make noise, the same thing for the birds. That's going to have a powerful impression. Either you're going to be in awe and admiration, or you're going to be envious. And you had either one of those two reactions. And as wonderful as the Western Middle Ages were compared with today, you didn't have anywhere near the high culture of Byzantium. 717 AD, Byzantium was in serious trouble. The Arabs conquered the Middle East, parts of the Anatolia, and they eventually aimed their guns at Constantinople. Umayyad Caliphate. He was able to put together 100,000 men and 5,000 ships against 15,000 Byzantine guards of the city. The empire was saved by this knowledge of physics, by the Greek fire. the so-called fire ships. You've seen this in the Bautian flamethrower. In 434 BC is the first time we hear about it against the Peloponnesian War. Was made up of naphtha, which is a kind of petroleum mix. You can find a lot of it in Armenia. But even Parthia, the siege warfare where they're used, fire weapons, but nothing came close to what the Greeks were able to do. This was a manifestation of Rome. It came at the nick of time. Lemachos of Heliopolis, a Syrian Greek who was also a chemist, said to have brought the formula to the emperor at the worst possible time. 7th, 8th century AD, Islam was taking everything. The fire, there was a mixture of naphtha, quicklime, and sulfur, and ignited through rosin, wax, and saltpeter. There's people like Africanus was able to give a basic formula, but the actual practical formula isn't known today entirely. It was a state secret. You had fire weapons used throughout the ancient world, but none of them came close, even afterwards, to the Greek fire. The Greek version was far more powerful. It burned hotter and had a higher volume. The Crusaders, for example, when they took on Byzantium, were terrifying. The flame was enormous, about the length of a lance. The noise was like thunder. It was deafening to hear this shot at you, whether it be on land or on sea. Mostly it was, of course, on the sea. The heat and the light were almost overwhelming, that it was like the sun. This is a manifestation of the knowledge of the world that connection with Logos gives. I mean, even the Venetians, after the fall of Constantinople, they couldn't put this together the way that the Byzantines have done. You had this huge cauldron that had the mixture within it, heated from below, the inlet pipe, which was pressurized, usually using a bellows, then the outlet valve, which is, essentially a barrel. So this heated, pressurized liquid through the nozzle where the flame was, and it came out to the point where it couldn't be extinguished. And it was swivel mounted by 360 degrees. So you had kind of a target, in a furnace, guide light at the very end of it. Even modern flamethrowers still have something like that. This saved the empire. And it came at the very nick of time, which of course led many to say this was a simple divine intervention. The Byzantine navy manifesting the dominance of the sea was the old style galley, usually with rows of oars. The hidroma, I guess, is the term for it. They had developed new hull construction, new methods of designing ships. You didn't really have the massed ship battles anymore. It was mostly raiding, anti-piracy act. Piracy was always a problem in the Byzantine Empire. And of course, they were designed for speed. They used certain, not even Greek fire, but they used boarding methods to take ships. This wasn't cannonades back and forth like in the modern era. But they were slow, when they were fully loaded, the fire ships were slow, not the galleys themselves. Were slow because they were so heavy with this stuff, and they had a fairly short range, maybe about a ship's length away. The fire weapon was a manifestation of hell. It was a metaphor, I should say, for hell. And this reached a point where the Second Lateran Council, 1139, tried to ban the use of Greek fire as it was too murderous. Well, clearly the only reason that could be the case was that Westerners were extremely upset by it. This is what saved the empire more than once. Even earlier, 672 AD, the Sassanid Empire took Asia Minor, all of it. So even a few generations before 770, we still had, I said it was the first mention, it's the second mention, Constantine the Second. And it stopped the Arab expansion. This massive, whether it be the Sassanid, the Umayyad, any attempt to blockade Constantinople because it was only connected to land on one side, was defeated. And by the way, the fire came out of dragon. You know, dragon from the apocalypse. Now, I'm going to go get into this in more detail some other time, possibly next week. And the military strategy, but the point of it is that this is a very powerful example, a military example, of what the symbolism of the empire was. God is Lord of heaven and earth, and hell too. It's not independent of God. In fact, it's a manifestation of it. The glory, the light of Logos can do all of these things. Either it can give you tremendous joy, because this is what you've been working for your whole life, or it will torture you tremendously because you're not prepared for it. It's sort of the grace, sort of the vestment that you wear in front of the divine fire. Again, fire is a metaphor, but the divine fire is used right in the liturgical text too. And the fact that it came miraculously, the ninth hour, is extremely important. But the significance of Byzantium in terms of the ontological hierarchy, there's no connection between that and military victory. They could be defeated without changing anything. The 1204 massacre reinforced it. And it went to Nicaea and Epirus, and Epirus down south. So again, place isn't that important. Rome simply moved to much smaller locations. So it was either the Western kingdom on one side or the Eastern empires on the other that caused enough trouble for the empire. But they were ontologically distinct. The defense of Constantinople to Greek fire was also reminiscent of Michael the Archangel playing Lucifer out of heaven. And Lucifer became the enemy, became Setan or Satan. The walls, I know even Odentius, 20th century, Odentius, talked about the cannons as the walls of Constantinople. These were engineering marvels. They were very thick. There was three of them. These attacks I mentioned in Constantinople from the early Middle Ages on, right into the end, it took months and months of pounding which the Muslims were able to take over because of the super cannons they created. These massive cannons that smashed into these walls. So this is as much connected to symbolism and ontology of the palace as anything else. But this is why 1204 was such a huge shock. It was a monstrous shock because they were able to rape the palace. So many of the buildings in the West in this period of time, the Middle Ages, comes from raw material stolen from a Constantinople emperor. So anyway, this is the function of the court military offices. The example of the Greek fire, we'll talk about this in more practical terms later, as the very special, this is a bit of knowledge that only those close to Logos have. It was a state secret, and there was a state monopoly over the production of Greek fire, and not only the formula, but the mechanism. There were attempts to imitate it, and they never were able to. But even, fire is often a metaphor for grace in the presence of God, the activity of God. And so when they would create these fires, just like the Russians are doing in Ukraine today, creating these fire puckers, where they simply soaked an area with ships lined up all facing the same direction, and this huge fireball was created, which destroyed anything it touched. That's no different than a sinner coming across God for the first time, dying and coming across and being confronted by divine grace. This is one of the same thing. Of course, there are layers of understanding here. But there is nothing in the political understanding or the social understanding of man wasn't connected with this ontology, this hierarchy of values. And I deal with this at some length. That was in my earlier book, Middle Ages, Medieval Political Philosophy, but also in this more, even more fundamentally, in this book on ancient science and ancient religion. Thank you for listening to me. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.